This is exactly right.
On the 12th season of Tenfold More Wicked, we investigate a series of compelling mysteries from the city of Fall River, Massachusetts, where problems started generations before Lizzie Borden's murders made her a household name. Join me as we cover the misfortunes that have befallen this infamous town for more than 150 years, including the Great Fire of 1843. Season 12 premieres Monday, May 13th on Exactly Right. Follow Tenfold More Wicked on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
A very special Saturday episode.
This is so weird for us.
Of My Favorite Murder.
We don't record Saturday.
No, we record like midnight on Wednesday, usually.
We try to schedule it. We're like, how painful will this be for Steven to have to edit into the early morning hours?
That's right. How tired can we make Steven be tomorrow?
That's all we care about. But today, because I am going out of town, we have to do adjustments.
For Father's Day tomorrow.
That's right. And so, yeah, that's the worst because we just recorded and then we have to turn around and do one more book report real quick.
Or like think of new things to talk about because it's not been a week. I don't have anything. What did you get your dad for Father's Day?
I think we're getting him a new iPhone.
Oh, my goodness.
Because his iPhone, first of all, I've talked about this, but he loves Apple products. He's a big believer in Apple. He's owned stock. Well, he owned stock for a while, but then the market and everything crashed. So he used to be like, are you rich, Dad, secretly and not telling us? He's like, nope. But he very much, it's almost like it's a Bay Area thing a little bit where it's like those boys from San Jose.
Right, they're our boys.
Yep. They were in the garage together and now look at them.
I like to support those, our neighbors.
Those nerds down south. So he's had a 5 forever.
Oh my gosh.
Which now iPhone 5s look like credit cards. They're so tiny.
Yeah.
It's like this little thing. So now we get to get him a actual man size.
Will you get yourself one too? Because you need an upgrade.
Okay. I also need, thank you for my permish. I love you for that. Because I would never do it. I'll
Unless
wait until I
Georgia
drop
says.
It. Yeah. I can't do it. That's greedy.
Why? You
it's greedy.
It is.
I'm selfish.
Greed is good. No, it's not. Your phone is slow. And you're a busy, you're working. That's basically your office. So you're like getting a nice office. That's all.
You're exactly right. And let me add on a laptop to that because mine.
That's right.
So remember how for a while it would be moody and all of a sudden I couldn't do a P.
Yes.
I wouldn't be able to type P. Then I spilled water on it and all kinds of stuff
started
happening.
Didn't everything go orange at one point or something?
Yes. There was some weird screen where I was like, did I just win on asteroids? What just happened? My computer. And for a while I was convinced that Russians are watching me in a strange mirror image on my laptop.
They are.
But now it just doesn't do stuff sometimes. Like I'll just be typing and then it just freezes
it's
for
like,
a while.
Uh-uh.
I need to throw that thing out.
Do it.
That's what you do, right? You throw it into a ravine.
It's probably the safest thing to do, actually.
Try to take that battery out and then just huck it off of a street on Mulholland.
Do it. If you hit someone in the head, you get extra points.
Yeah.
But do it. I got my dad. Can I tell you? I almost just did this to like, because I thought this was such a good idea to be like, yes, I'm going to support this.
Yes.
For Father's Day, there was like a 30% discount at 23andMe. And I was just like, I fucking love you guys. That's like the best marketing. I'm going to get that for my dad.
Oh, I bet he'd love that.
Yeah, he's totally into it. We like got contacted once by someone who maybe was a family member and all this shit. And so I got that for him. And I just love that it's like the perfect timing of like, hey, do you all kids want to see if your dad's a murderer? Like, let's get him a discount.
Let's upload some shit.
Exactly.
You know, I think I told you this, but I joined Ancestry.com because my mother's father was stabbed in a bar fight. But I was like, what's the detail of that? I know my family's not telling me the whole story.
Oh my God.
And no one's ever told anybody the whole story.
And he died?
Yeah.
How old is he?
That's how he died. It was when my mom was 21.
Oh my God.
And it was the day she found out, and the next day she had to take her nursing test to become a licensed RN.
And did she pass?
Yes, she did. Isn't that weird?
That's crazy.
She said she didn't know, she has no memory of taking the test, and she doesn't know how she passed it.
She cheated.
That's also on the ancestry file.
Did you find anything?
No, I couldn't figure out, like, it just brought up like a couple things, and I couldn't figure out how to make it go to where I wanted.
Dude, we got to go to the Sacramento, the Petaluma Library, and get some microfiche action going on.
It's San Francisco. All of those people were San Francisco style.
Even more fun. We'll put on some like fucking like scary music while we do it.
Like Starship.
What's that?
You know, Jefferson Airplane later in the 80s became Starship, which is they're from the Bay Area and everyone's very proud.
So they buy all their phones.
They do a lot of microfiche research.
Okay, I love it.
Yes.
That's crazy.
I know, isn't that nuts?
Someone look that up for Karen.
Can you figure out how my grandpa died? Never met him. Heard he wasn't the greatest.
Okay, what's that in your hand?
This is...
Heard he wasn't the greatest.
Rumor has it, according to my mother, not the best dad. So last episode, I was telling one of my ripoff I Survived stories. Mm-hmm. And in it, I referenced the I Survived story I wasn't talking about, but it was also in the same episode, about the man who was attacked by a bear and his dog Ladybug, who helped him survive. But I didn't know if Ladybug had survived. Yeah. And in my mind, I'd remembered it because I have watched the entire episode minimum twice, but I couldn't remember. And the man himself who tells the story, looks sad in the face, probably because he had his scalp ripped off by a bear once.
Jesus Christ.
I mean, it's a crazy story. Is crazy, but he just has a little bit of a, like, you know, ness to him. So I was like, that's a guy whose dog died. That's
maybe
a guy
who lost all the nerves in his forehead when they sewed his fucking scalp back on.
Shit, maybe. Although, nothing's connected up there. That's why, like,
well, I can't move mine. That's because of Botox. See this?
We should take video. Georgia trying to move her face.
I'm trying to furrow my brows so hard.
As an example.
There.
And then a muscle pops out of your eye.
Or just the Botox comes squirting out of my forehead.
And then into my forehead. Yeah. And, oh my God, now I'm a believer. I was looking at this divot that I have in my forehead that looks, I used to call it the hatchet wound, because it's not just a wrinkle, like, it's always been a deep,
because you furrow your brow all the
crevasse.
Time.
Yeah, I do all kinds of stuff up here.
Yeah.
But I mean, I don't know. I feel like this needs surgery to go away.
Honey, let me introduce you to the powers that are Botox.
No way.
Absolutely. That's what it's for. Yeah.
But it's deep, and I think there's like actually bone loss underneath it.
How? Did you smack your head?
No, I just keep rubbing my finger on it like this over and over.
No, that I can tell you right now, a little bit of Botox will get rid of that.
Jesus Christ. And you'll be like
a believer. A believer. Right. Maybe I'll be a believer.
What if I do? Then suddenly I can't stop talking about Justin Bieber. Yeah. What if I do Botox, but only on this, and then they leave the rest of my face aged?
You can do that. Your face isn't aged.
Thanks, Georgia.
You're welcome.
Okay, so this is the update that we got. It says, update on the dogs of episode 125. It's from Kristen. Okay. And she says, I was pretty concerned over the fate of the dogs in the I Survived stories Karen talked about.
Honey,
and mentioned, so I had to research. Oh. It turns out in both cases, the dogs survived.
Oh my God, in both the stories.
Both,
that's right.
Even Ladybug, she says. From the Appalachian.
Appalachian.
No. Appalachian. Appalachian.
Yeah, I saw you get corrected on Twitter for that.
Sure. But also there was a couple of people who are like, every single person says it like this. That's what I imagined in my mind that they were yelling at me. But then lots of people were like, look, I live over here and I never heard that.
Yeah.
But we got that great tweet of a guy sent us a tweet that said, if you say it Appalachian, I'll throw an Appalachia. And that's how you know it's Appalachian.
Appalachian.
That's your
Appalachian.
Mnemonic reminder, whatever it's called. Okay. So here's what happened. From the Appalachian Trail Killer story, Randall Lee Smith, parentheses, why are all serial killers names three words?
We know the answer to that.
Go ahead, tell them.
It's because they're not named three words. They just include their middle name when they identify them, so that Randall Smith in fucking Belmont, Where's Belmont,
California.
And Belmont, California doesn't suddenly get labeled a serial killer.
Yeah, so
they use
like,
three names.
I'm Randall Marie Smith. Right. Please leave me alone. Randall Marie Smith, you get up on this porch and you stop killing people on the Appalachian Trail. Okay, so Randall Lee Smith's dog, Bo. Oh, starving Bo.
Boy dogs named Bo and female dogs named Lady are like the best dogs.
Lady. So Bo was adopted, though it wasn't mentioned to whom. That'd be so weird. They give a name, yeah, picture of the person.
Here's his phone number.
From an article printed at the time, quote, Randall Lee Smith was buried next to his mother at the Fairview Cemetery in Narrows. Mm. His dog, Bo, scratched in the dirt at the graveside ceremony. He has since been adopted.
Oh.
That's like...
He still loved his owner.
I think that's the only person that loved Randall Lee Smith.
Oh, dogs are so good.
Dogs do their best.
They do their best.
And he was like... This is my owner who gave me fish. And then it's like, no, Scott gave you fish.
Yeah.
Not your owner.
My owner fed me. And I just didn't look when he was doing the other stuff. So I don't know what happened. I was taking a nap.
I get distracted there anytime there's anything that smells good.
You guys,
or
there's a squirrel.
Yeah.
I mean, have you met a squirrel? It's so much fun.
Have you ever been on a trail? There's 1,000 squirrels.
The smells are everywhere.
Everywhere. There's so much pee. And then, from the bear attack story on the same episode, Ladybug, who helped save her owner from the grizzly mauling, actually did survive. Quote, I believe that Ladybug saved my life, the man who got attacked, who we're still not naming, said, noting that the dog also survived the ordeal and is okay. Both stories have taught me to stay out of the forest forever. Stay sexy and don't let your dog get murdered, Kristen.
Aww.
Good job, Kristen. Thank you for doing that research.
Good job, Kristen.
If we could all just do my research for me, that would be best.
I have a message from my story last week about the glamour girl slang. And at the very end, I talk about how there's a possible connection to one other long cold case. And I say about how the murder victims 50 years after she was discovered, is the Jane Doe is finally, what am I saying?
Yeah, I hear you.
Determined to who it is based on the great niece.
Okay.
Remember that? She was like, I'm going to sleuth it. And she's like, and I was like, I bet she's a murderino. She messaged us.
Oh, shit, girl.
She says, Michelle Fowler here. Dot was my great aunt and the MFM ladies were right. I am a, quote, fucking murderino.
Hi. Hi, Michelle.
Amazing.
That's so
just
exciting.
Wanted to say thanks for the credit regarding solving Dot's disappearance, but it doesn't all belong to me. The Doe Network was what led me to Dot. The Boulder Sheriff's Department, Vidicq Society, V-I-D-I-C-Q Society, Boulder, Sylvia Petum, and a whole host of people helped identify Dot. Thank you for keeping Dot's memory alive, SSDGM.
Awesome.
I know.
That's really cool.
That's so generous.
Is it
Vidoc? I would take all the credit.
V-I-D-O-C?
Q.
Or O-Q?
O-C. V-I-D-I-C-Q. Vidicq. Stephen, will you look up and see what that is?
See if you can't get a phonetical pronunciation.
No, or just see what it does, what they do and who they are.
She's like, I didn't do it alone. I would also like to give credit, but this is not related to your case or my case.
Good.
This is related to... because I'm going up north, I have to board my dogs.
Uh-huh.
But I've never boarded Frank before because he's from the streets. And I've always known it wouldn't work out. And the place that I board my dogs is pretty intense. It's like one of those, it's like, this is a wonderful farm heaven where your dogs can roam free. And
really?
There's a water park and all this stuff. But they have to pass a test to be boarded.
It's
there.
A don't bite people to face test.
Yes.
I couldn't pass that. Could you? That's hard.
It would be hard for me too.
Yeah.
So he had to go. I dropped them off this morning and then I was like, but I want to leave them here because I want to leave tomorrow unless he doesn't pass the test. And I had to basically plan.
Yeah.
Because George is in. If Frank doesn't get into
the
private
sweet
school.
Little George girl is just like, I like everybody.
I want to do what everybody else wants to do.
And fucking Frank is like, I might bite you.
Yeah. Frank's like, I don't trust anyone.
Oh.
I don't understand what's happening and I just want
to
bark.
And I'm so close to the ground. I just am a little, it's a little scary. Everything is, I have to look up to see anything.
But I don't like looking up. Yeah. So I got the call at noon that Frank passed and they were going to let him stay. But it was kind of sad because she said, he is a little shy, which does not sound like Frank at all.
He misses you.
So he's a little freaked out. But I think once he, because he's separate from George because it's big dogs, little dogs.
Aww.
But then I'm sure they let them come back together and then he'll be fine.
Oh my God, that's so sweet.
Because he loves my dog sitter's dogs.
Oh, okay.
So it's not like he doesn't. He'll be fine.
He'll be fine unless you get a call. You need to come pick your dog up, ma'am.
If anyone would do it, it's Frank. He is, I don't know how he does it, but he like is the most accident prone. I told you the time, I've told you this at least twice. The time he stood up to put his head out the window in the car, stood on the window roller downer thing.
No.
And began to fall out the window, and I, as we're driving down my street, I have to lean over and grab him by the tail and pull him back into the car.
I thought you were going to say he stood on the window rolly thing and rolled his fucking face up into the window.
No, he rolled it down and then began to fall out as I'm trying to like get somewhere.
That's terrifying.
And that's Frank in a nutshell. Like he does things where you're like, this is like a, it's like a Rube Goldberg machine of you getting killed and I come in at the last second and save you every time.
Oh my God.
He also, anytime he stands on the couch, changes the channel. Like he always knows to stand right on the clicker.
I love that.
He's amazing.
That's adorable.
Yeah.
Oh, I want to say I have a thank you corner.
Okay.
Because I complained about my car key on the last episode, how it unlocked all the car doors automatically.
Oh, yes. Yes.
And I mean, everyone from everywhere who's ever owned a car apparently knows that it's easy to fucking change that.
Yes.
And they all told me and I appreciate it.
Oh, good.
And someone even sent me like step-by-step directions because I clearly haven't done it yet still. I was like, great, good to know. And then I'll never do it.
Right.
But I appreciate that.
I love that they're like, it's this easy.
I know.
You do this, you do this.
That's what's great about this podcast. You could be like, how is this thing? And then people would be like, this is how it is. And
yes.
Like, great. I'm smarter now.
The best. That's the key. Yeah. We need that.
That's what this podcast is truly about, is we just pretend it's true crime and we really just get help from everyone.
Yes. It's so good.
Oh, so join the fan cult because now we're going to be posting unboxing videos.
Oh, yes. Because we get so many gifts in that P.O. box.
Right.
And they're amazing and they're from all over the place. And we have the best time opening them privately.
Yeah. We just like open them and we're all like, ooh, and ah. And then last week we were like, let's do this on video.
Yeah. People would like to see this because it's also all the, like there's art that are like inside jokes that we have with you guys that you should be seeing.
There's a fucking incredible skirt with Elvis. It's got the pattern that was made is Elvis with cookies all over it. And it's this gorgeous skirt. So if you go to join the fan cult, myfavoritemurder.com, you can join it and you'll see those videos. We'll just keep doing them.
And we're thinking of more and more videos to make because we know that's like a super fun element. We're just trying to make the fan cult the thing you want it to be, of like a extra special connection thing. We want to do it too. We're just like, we just have to get our shit together.
Do a forum of what you'd want to see too, because we don't know.
I mean, yeah, I just suggested something to Georgia and she's like, I don't know, people want to see it. I'm like, yeah, right? Yeah. Isn't that kind of what it's all about?
Yeah, please.
We don't know.
It was just me screaming naked through a field.
Yeah. Dude, and I was like, people love the way you scream.
Is that it?
Yes. Goodbye.
Do you have anything else?
Go ahead, Steven.
Oh, I was going to say, I looked up the vid.
Cool. Oh, yeah.
The vid ICQ society is...
I want to say it's Vidoc.
Vidoc.
I'm just putting it out there.
I think you're right, yeah.
But what about that other I? Okay, I believe you.
I'm just putting a random thing out there.
I agree.
It's basically like a venue where like-minded persons in and out of forensics would gather to discuss and debate crimes and mysteries. So it was established in 1990 by, it doesn't say their name, but people who worked in the U.S. Customs Service Special Agency.
Customs?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Founded by William Fleischer, Frank Bender, and Richard Walter. What does VSM mean? Does that mean like FBI? Or
they're
forensics?
Priests.
Oh. So, yeah.
Three priests that worked for customs.
Cool.
Yeah, look at them.
Let's see.
Are they nerds?
Yes, I've definitely seen this place before. Because, yeah, it's basically people who have experience and education in forensics that get together and go, how do we maybe solve these
and
crimes?
Everyone can bring one, like a cold case and be like, can we do this one? We need help with this.
Exactly. They have to. You have to bring a cold case and a bottle of vodka. Top shelf.
And by the time the bottle of vodka is finished, the cold case is solved.
Yes.
Learning things. Okay. Do you go first this week or do I go first?
I think I went first last week, which was 4 days ago.
Right. I had to wait to drink till you were done.
God damn
that
it.
That sucked.
Should I sit on this blanket because of things?
Yes, that is a barf couch.
Got it.
That is a cat barf couch. Is it bothering you?
No, I can. I just don't want to get a hot butt.
Oh, is it a warm butt?
Not right now. I'm fine. I was just like, I'll pull it out if not, but it doesn't matter.
It's just embarrassing.
I don't want to sit in barf. This is great.
I mean, it's old barf.
It is. How old?
Well, how do you clean barf off? Everyone, how do you clean barf
She's
off the couch?
She's screaming at me. You
no,
heard
I'm
it.
Embarrassed.
You heard it.
Now I have a hot face.
I'm sorry. We can take all this out.
No, I don't
Hot face
shit.
And a hot butt like on one
three
show?
Three fucking cats. Clearly, my house is going to be disgusting. I am okay with that.
Okay.
Hey, Karen, you know that feeling when you're stressed out and your heart starts to pound and your mind is racing?
I do. I know it well.
Well, while there's no cure for stress, therapy can help shape your response to it. And since May is Mental Health Awareness Month, there's no better time to try Talkspace.
When you sign up for Talkspace, you'll receive a personalized match with a therapist or psychologist, typically within 48 hours.
Forbes rates Talkspace as the number one online therapy platform, plus their licensed professionals are in-network with almost all major insurance companies.
Once you meet your therapy goals, or if you want to cancel for any reason, Talkspace will provide you with a prorated refund for unused time. I feel like these days people understand the importance of therapy, but the difficult part is just taking that first step. It took me months to make my first therapy appointment. I was so scared. I had a lot of ideas in my head about it. And that's why I think Talkspace is such a good idea, because making it so approachable will just get you there sooner. Then you can actually get in there, figure out what you need, talk to an actual professional, and be on your way to solving some stuff that you might want to solve.
To celebrate Mental Health Awareness Month and the power of talking it out in therapy, Talkspace is offering our listeners $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80.
Go to Talkspace.com/MFM and use promo code SPACE80.
To match with a licensed therapist today, go to Talkspace.com/MFM and enter promo code SPACE80 and get $80 off your first month and show your support for our show.
That's Talkspace.com/MFM. Enter promo code SPACE80.
Goodbye.
There's something about the sound of an old-timey cash register that really takes me back.
I know. It sounds like someone is about to hand me an ice cream cone, but it also sounds like we just sold some merch.
That's right. And if you're a Shopify user like us, you know that this sound means you just made a sale.
Shopify has helped millions of businesses sell their products online, but did you know they also offer the same support for brick and mortar stores?
From accepting payments to managing inventory, they have everything you need to sell in person. So give your point of sale system a serious upgrade with Shopify.
Shopify POS tracks sales across all your locations. That way, you'll always know what you have in stock and where.
They also provide reliable tech that fits your unique retail needs, like turning a tablet into a credit card reader.
And if you're looking to reach new customers, check out Shopify's marketing tools. They're easy to use and they integrate with all social media platforms.
With Shopify, we have a powerful partner for managing our sales. And if you're a business owner, you can too.
Do retail right with Shopify.
Sign up for a $1 per month trial period today at shopify.com/murder. And here's the important note, that promo code is all lowercase.
So go to shopify.com/murder and take your retail business to the next level.
That's shopify.com/murder. Again, don't forget, the code is all lowercase.
Goodbye.
What was I gonna say? Okay. All right. So as you are and I survived retailer.
Yes.
This week I'm going to be a confessions tapes retailer.
Whoa. People write to us about you have to watch that all the time.
Yeah. It's really good. And I started watching it when it first came out. It's like, this is exciting. But it turns out that people falsely confessing and people being wrongly, wrongly accused and wrongly all this shit really upsets me in a way that I can't handle it. So I stopped watching them. Like, I've started watching like half of them and they're really fucking troubling.
Yes, it's horrifying. Yeah. It's like, this man spent 25 years in hell.
Yeah.
For no reason.
Yeah. And the person, yeah. It's really, really troubling, but it's a really well done show. It's on Netflix, The Confession Tapes. If you can handle that shit, go for it. So the other night I was bored and I was like, all right, there's one of these I've never tried to watch. I'm going to try to watch it. And I ended up being like blown the fuck away by
this
story.
Awesome. Okay, cool.
And it's in Michigan. So I was like, Vince, do you remember this? And he's like, yeah, because this was a huge fucking story in Michigan.
Okay.
That I had never even heard of. All right. So this is the case of Lawrence or Larry Delisle.
Hmm.
Yeah. This is one of those cases. It's really reminiscent of Susan Smith and Aunt Diane. It also kind of reminds me of those stories of like people who leave their kids in cars and like, did they or didn't they do it on purpose? Those crazy stories.
Yeah.
All right. So here we go. On the evening. It's also sad, but here we go. On the evening of August 3rd, 1989, I was... stop to like get my bearings and
because you have to picture it.
Yeah,
89. I was living in Sacramento.
Yeah,
I was, it was nine.
Right,
you were nine,
and like, you know, everything's this and that. You're in the 80s. Here we are,
late 80s, past the MTV era. Now we're into some. We're into more of everyone's trying to be more New York-y, more.
Oh yeah, highbrow
Mac makeup. Brown lipstick.
Yeah.
Might be a bit early for that, but.
Yeah, I think it's a more Duran Duran kind of thing going on.
Yeah. But that's, the sun is setting on Duran Duran.
Okay. So it's the evening of August 3rd, 1989. Lawrence, I'm going to call him Larry. Larry Delisle, D-E-L-I-S-L-E, of Lincoln Park, which is a suburb outside of Detroit.
And your favorite band.
That's fucking right. Long live Lincoln Park. Took his family out on a drive. So they're in the station wagon. Larry's 28 years old. He has a steady job as a mechanic. He mainly works on brakes and for the front end. I don't know what that means.
The front part of the car.
Front end of a car. Sure. All right. And just as his father had done before him. So the car that the Delisle family is driving that night is a Ford LTD station wagon.
Mm-hmm.
And it had belonged to Larry's dad. But less than two years earlier, his dad had killed himself in the car, shot himself in the fucking head in the car. And they kept the car, and they even had, like, still had blood stains in the car that they couldn't wash out.
No.
So, yeah, they kept the car.
Horrifying.
With the blood stain, but, you know, he makes like $4.50 an hour, and they have four kids. It's not like they have the money to then go buy a car.
True. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
But the emotional.
Yes.
I get like it's a necessity, and yet the emotional toll of that is awful.
It's like not really here nor there in the story. It's just this crazy. Maybe it is. Who knows?
Right.
So that night, the family, the wife is Suzanne, 8-year-old Brian, 4-year-old Catherine, 2-year-old Melissa, and 8-month-old Emily. I know. Went to town of Wyandotte. Which is a word, which is part of the area known as Downriver.
Okay.
And they go into shop for bedroom furniture for the girls, and they get ice cream at the local frozen custard shop, which I know from Vince is a thing.
Good.
In fucking Michigan. Yeah.
For like a little while, there was a frozen custard shop at the Beverly Center.
Oh.
It was down by Macy's, kind of in a corner.
No, I never went.
Oh.
How is it different? It's just thicker?
Yeah, because it's frozen yogurt's like the diet version.
Yeah.
Frozen custard is like the fatty version.
Fuck yeah.
And it is good.
Man, any kind of fucking soft serve, I'm on board.
Same. This is like soft, if they put butter in soft serve. I mean, there's something to it where you're just like, this is the best thing
Walking
ever.
Walking somewhere with a soft serve cone is like my fucking dream.
Did you guys have Foster's Freeze in Orange County?
No, but they have them here, and Vince makes me go to them sometimes. There's like one left in like Glendale or Burbank.
Right. It's in Glendale.
Yeah.
Because that was kind of the main, you could, you know, after school, we would just walk around downtown Petaluma.
Yeah.
And there was a Foster's Freeze. I don't know what it is now. But it was a walk-up window with a little screen. And you'd go up and be like half and half dipped. And then walk around with this ice cream.
No, we were fucking she waspy neighborhood. So we had Heidi's Frozen Yogurt. No, it was called Heidi's... What was it called? Hold on.
Heidi's Rich Lady Frozen Yogurt.
Yeah. Do you remember?
I just remember Golden Spoon.
Golden Spoon we had. There was like a penguin.
Pretty on the nose.
Yeah.
I know penguins.
Okay. It was just sushi.
Yeah.
You know, diet stuff. Okay.
Well, everyone thought it was diet. It's so not diet. Yeah. It's so not.
Okay. Ba-ba-ba-ba-ba, da-da-da-da, then the custard shop. So, according to Larry, as they left the ice cream shop, one of the daughters said, can we go see the boats again, Daddy? And they had done so the night before as well. So what she meant by that was that she wanted to drive. They would drive down to the end of Eureka Road, which was a dead end street. And right when you got to the dead end street, there was a wood and metal little barricade,
mm-hmm.
and then a couple feet of grass, and then it went right into the Detroit River.
Okay.
So there was like really nothing keeping you from just walking right into the Detroit River. Right.
Okay.
There. But they would pull up to the end to that spot in the car. And because the Detroit River is one of the busiest border crossings in the world for cargo boats.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. Smart. You normally can see boats go by, and it was at night and all the boats were lit up. And so the little kids would be like, "We're the boats," or whatever, right? Which is like, that makes sense. And when I was a kid, we used to do a thing called, we would leave my aunt's house, which was in like Palos Verdes, we'd go over a hill and you could see the city light up, and we'd go, "The lights of the city." It was like our favorite thing.
Oh,
you know, kids like stupid shit. They're real dumb.
Yeah, the good stuff.
Yeah. So the youngest daughter, Emily, though, who's 8 months old, she's teething, though, and starts to cry. So they're like, "Let's get the fuck out of here." So they head out, but first they stop in at a drugstore that was around the corner. And when they leave, according to Larry, he misjudged his turn and instead goes back in the direction of the dead end.
I don't like that.
Mm-mm. Larry says he'd been having leg cramps and pain all day in his calf, and he had taken off his shoes while he drove because of it. And he said he suddenly had a very painful leg cramp, and it caused his foot to stomp down on the gas. And he had to reach down and manually, like almost like a Charlie horse where you can't move your leg, had to manually pull his leg off the gas. But he said that even when he had done so, the car didn't slow down, that the accelerator had stuck for some reason.
Okay.
So those two things, this is what happened.
Now, I will say this. One time I was driving my sister's 1968 Mustang up D Street in Petaluma, and the accelerator pedal dropped to the ground, and suddenly I was going 70 miles an hour down.
I feel like that's happened to me before.
Yeah, on older cars, like that, it was the craziest thing. And as I was driving, like, increasingly...
Was there a train coming at the same time?
I was right on the train tracks.
Oh, my God!
And then... Honk, honk. No.
God damn it. That would have been cool.
But I basically was accelerating to the point where I was like, I'm going to run this stop sign. Like, it was crazy. And then I got
the train was coming.
And then the train was coming. I got my foot under and kicked it back up.
Holy shit. You had to like flip it?
Yes. And I think I've always been a little bit stuck up because of that moment.
Oh, you're so smart.
Where instead of panicking, I was like, you have to fix this, because I was in a racing car toward death.
Isn't it crazy to think about like what you would have done? I mean,
yes.
My brother once was in a car with his friend who started having a seizure on the freeway while he was driving.
No.
And we had to climb over him and like get on, like get, pull the car over.
Fuck.
I know. And I'm like, Asher, you are a fucking, like,
you're a monster.
You're a Superman.
Because you know, that is like why I used to have panic attacks.
Oh, God.
My first panic attack was driving 70 miles an hour down up the 101. And all of a sudden it hit me.
You could have a seizure at any moment.
I could have a seizure at any moment and kill myself and everybody around me. And I mean, I had a panic attack that like I didn't drive on the freeway for 4 years. It was crazy.
I theorized that the reason I always move in with boyfriends immediately is because the one seizure I've ever had was in my sleep.
Oh, yeah.
So I don't want to fucking sleep alone. Yep. You know,
that was after my seizures. Thank God my boyfriend Kevin at the time was so good. I slept with him every night, and he had to talk me to sleep every night, because I would, the second I lay down, I would start having panic attacks that I was going to have a seizure. It's so fucked up.
That sucks, dude.
But I want to introduce this. So I believe that story as much as I do not believe that story.
Right.
Because how fucking convenient.
That's this whole story. I mean, you and I are going to have, like, we have to decide.
Okay, great.
Because it's, right now it's like, I see that story happening.
Yeah.
All right. This is a bummer. Here
and
we go.
And it happened to me once.
I know.
But not the cramp part. I don't like the cramp part. It doesn't jibe.
But if you get the... I feel like in an older car, if you push the accelerator all the way to the ground, that's a place where it could get stuck. So the leg cramp, pushing it to the ground might be a good... like, makes sense, because it's not like you just tapped on it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Although, I was just... not that it's all exactly the same every time.
Do it.
But when I was... when I was going 30 miles an hour, so only lightly tapped my foot, that thing dropped as if a piece of metal had broken and didn't come back up. So it wasn't about force.
Yeah.
It was like a thing down there, a spring broke.
Yeah.
Whatever it was. So I have a lot of opinions, but I don't know where to put them.
It's on this podcast. It's the answer.
You tell me.
No, the opinions go on this podcast. Okay. So then, wait, hold on. The accelerator was stuck. Meanwhile, let's cut to the top floor of a high-rise apartment building that was directly next to the dead-end street, and also looked over the Detroit River. It's like this pretty brick old apartment building. So their self-confessed nosy neighbor, Beverly Lake, was out on her balcony that night where she had mounted a high-powered binoculars on a tripod. Beverly is a fucking nosy, Nelly.
Yes, I am too.
About her nosiness, Beverly's husband once said to her, you know, if you keep doing this, someday you're going to witness a murder. Mm-hmm.
And she's like, that's exactly what we're trying to do.
Right. So she's on the 11th floor, as top floor. She has a bird's eye view of both Eureka Street and the dead end and the lake. The night before, she had witnessed and commented to her father, who was with her, about the Delisle family car, the station wagon, had pulled up there and was idling in front of the river, as he said they had done it the night before to mm-hmm. look at the boats. And when the car first came to the river that night, she noticed it again. So when they first came, and then they were like, fuck this shit, let's get out of here. So by her account, about 20 minutes after first seeing the car that night, at about 9:20 p.m., she hears a, quote, terrible roar and saw the station wagon head straight towards the barrier, full speed, followed by seeing the Delisle station wagon crack through the barrier. It becomes airborne and crashes like 30 to 50 feet into the water.
Fuck.
Yeah. And she says she never heard it slow down once. She heard the accelerator as it was flying through the air.
Wow.
And she hears Suzanne, the mom, scream as the car goes into the river.
Oh, God.
It's really terrible. The car ends up about 90 feet down south of the river because of the current, and it's 30 fucking feet deep.
Shit.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
I did not expect it to be that deep. So when the search and rescue arrive, and there's video of this, I mean, watch the confession tapes. It's troubling. They see the taillights are still visible of the car. I know. And they find Larry and Susan had escaped the car through the blown out front window. So when they hit the water, the front windshield blew out. They swam out. But all four children were trapped in their seats, still in the car at the bottom of the river. And they were pulled out, you know, hours of CPR were done, but sadly, none of the four children survived.
Oh, God.
And, okay. Police question Larry that night. He tells the investigators says something was stuck in the gas pedal. He was thinking that maybe his shoe had come loose and hit it, but police didn't buy his leg cramp story, especially when the doctors at the hospital couldn't find anything wrong with his leg at all. Also, for some reason, they were like, this is insane. Like, we just want to leave and go to Florida on vacation and get out of here. Like,
no, yeah. Bad move.
Yeah. But Suzanne supports him 100% and is like, that's exactly what happened. He didn't do it on purpose. This was an accident, you know.
Okay, that's good.
Yeah. So she stands by him. But of course, the fucking media goes bananas. It's a small town. Everyone knows each other and the media eats it up. It's super sensational. They even show the dead children being carried out of the Detroit River.
No.
I saw it. It's horrible. Wow.
And that's like when people see that, they go bananas.
It's an emotional reaction. And the police who were there that night helping also have this anger and emotional reaction to these dead children.
Yes.
And kind of a someone needs to be blamed for this kind of way.
Of course.
It's really fucking awful. There's one guy who's like, is being passed one of the children on a boat, and his eyes just looked insane in this way of like, this isn't really happening. He's clearly going to have PTSD after. It's really fucking awful.
I mean, that's the part of this job of first responders,
yeah,
that never gets talked about, where like they see horrible things. They see horrible things every goddamn,
yeah,
day. My mom told me once, and I won't tell the specifics of it because it's truly horrible and I wish she hadn't told me.
Oy.
But my dad saw something early on and she said he had nightmares about it. He would wake up with nightmares about it.
As a fireman.
As a fireman.
Uh-huh.
Because they do a lot of resuscitations. They don't just do,
yeah,
fires. It's,
yeah,
like, you know, when you call 911, the fire department is the one that comes. Yeah. And he just saw some pretty awful things that happened to children.
Yeah.
And, that he just had nightmares about it for years and years,
yeah,
and it kind of didn't go away. So the impact is terrible. It also makes me think of the community meeting that we talk about all the time in the Golden State Killer, mm-hmm, when the guy stands up and says, there's no way, mm-hmm, that if a man's in the house, he's going to let an intruder attack his wife.
Yeah.
It's that thing. I'm sure people said, I don't want to step on this. If this is,
no,
what's about to happen,
no,
how can you escape a yes. car that your children are still in.
Yes.
How can you swim away from that car?
Yes. And so I'm still on the fence about his guilt or innocence.
Oh.
So there is that argument, which I don't, you and I both have talked this many times. It's like you can't understand how people are going to react to things.
Right.
You know, they both swim to the surface, but apparently he doesn't know how to swim. Either.
Oh.
So, let me get it. Yeah, we'll talk about it. But yeah, you're right.
You know, I jumped it.
No. It's true. I mean, it's and when I first watched the confession tapes, I was like, he's so fucking innocent. This is all bullshit. He did it on accident. But the more I researched it in the past 10 hours, the more I'm like, I don't know.
Okay.
All right. So, the media goes crazy and, they show the video also of the station wagon. It's this dramatic video of the station wagon being plucked out of the river, and the media starts staking out the Delisle house until 5 days after the crash, when Larry and Suzanne agree to do an interview. So he looks like a not as intelligent, kind of pudgier Ted Bundy.
Oh, okay.
He looks like a working man's Ted Bundy.
Okay.
And she looks like every, I think, Midwestern mom.
Okay.
You know? So they're sitting on their little porch in front of their little house on lawn chairs and surrounded by reporters and cameras. They seem super dazed, but there's no emotion. They're just, you know, not reacting at all. And the fact that their kids had just, four kids had just been killed.
Yeah, they're
especially him.
Probably in shock.
Well, later, Larry says that he had taken two Valium before the interview, which is why he seems so calm. And he's like, I fucking shouldn't have done that. But it's also how we say, like, you never know how, you can't ever know how you're going to react in situations. And sometimes it's not how people want you to react.
Well, and that's why,
do it right.
Yeah, it's like how people are slowly learning that and how the press wants the story, and the press wants the thing that's going to sell magazines or these days get clicks.
Which is emotions.
Yes.
Raw emotions.
Exactly. So it's like, get in here and suddenly do you see the blue dress or the gold dress? Is this guy innocent or guilty? It's up to you.
But then they'll be like, she's too emotional. Those emotions are fake. They don't seem right. They seem forced. So there's no fucking way to win.
No, there's no, I mean, I think the way to win is like, why are these people speaking to the press days after four of their children died? Like,
yeah,
that's you don't
well,
have
why
to
are the
do
press
that.
Hounding them after their children just died?
Well, it's a yeah, I mean, Jesus,
because I think a lot of people in the community are like, how could they let their kids drown there? I would never let that happen. So everyone was like fired up about it.
Yeah.
So they talk casually about the crash, saying they didn't know what had happened. They didn't express any emotion or feeling. Of course, makes the public even more pissed off about them. On August 10th, 1989, a couple days after the crash.
Was that an earthquake?
No, there's someone on the tennis court.
Oh.
It's an earthquake of people playing good tennis really well. That's stupid. Okay. So Larry's brought in for questioning and a polygraph test by Sergeant John Paul Mader of Michigan State Police. All right. Paul Mader is known in law enforcement community for extracting confessions from people.
Uh-oh.
Which is a good, they're all like, that's a great thing.
Okay.
He's like, I can pull a rabbit out of a hat.
Right.
In their minds, he's super good at it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So this dude he's interviewed in the confession tapes. Listen, I'm not putting any judgment on whether or not the guy is guilty or innocent, got a fake confession or not, or if he's a good cop or not. I'm not saying any of that. He is a fucking douche.
Like,
not judgment on anything, but that fact that he is a fucking cocky douche.
And okay.
I really don't like him.
Okay.
But at one point he says to Larry, I've just been given a gift to look deeper into people than anyone ever thought possible to do. Like, he's just really into himself.
And he, in saying that, he believes that? When he's saying that?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
And
that's odd.
That he talks about how he's a Zen master and how he can pass a lie detector test himself. So this is just one of those confession tapes that are really problematic. He starts to make Larry believe that he's crazy and maybe he did do it on purpose, but just didn't realize it. One of those, like, you know, your subconscious mind took over and you were overwhelmed by the stress of, you know, your baby was crying. It was a hot night and maybe you're not a monster. I know you're not a monster, you know?
Yeah.
And if you tell me that you did it subconsciously, then we'll know that, you know.
And he has so much sway because this is a man who's lost his four children.
He's lost his four children. He also has a 10th grade education.
Mm.
So he's, you know, at one point.
Me too.
At one point, you know, he says, like, Larry's like, I must have been a monster if I had done it. And this guy goes, that's very astute of you to realize that. And he goes, what's astute? Like, he doesn't know what's going on. And he lies to him. He says, like, when we say something is done on purpose, does that mean there's pre-planning? Like, did you do it on purpose? Was it an accident? But it was, you know, telling him, oh, he was like, it really took courage to do what you did. Like, even making him feel
like he empathizes with him or is on his side.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so during the interrogation, it starts to look like Larry's nodding off and like he's hypnotized almost in this like trance-like state. And I think the videotape is 8 hours, but they interrogate him for 12 hours.
Jesus Christ.
With no lawyer. And during the interrogation, Larry cooperates. He seems to be getting along amiably with Sergeant Palmater. While Palmater talks to Larry, Larry seems to be in this trance, hypnotized. He does the whole thing of, Palmater does, like, I can totally understand why you did this, and you're a victim too, just trying to get him to, like,
agree.
Yeah. And the whole time Larry's like, this can't be true, like, questioning it himself, like, maybe it is. He seems to have no effect or personality, just kind of closes his eyes to the ordeal. He seems to start parroting back the suggestions that Palmater had said to him, which is a big thing about forced confessions, is parroting back what that person told, you know, said might have happened.
Like word for word.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it leads the police to say that they got a confession from him, even though there's no real confession happening. After that night, that same night, after 12 hours of interrogation, Delisle is charged with 4 counts of first-degree murder and the deaths of his children, and 1 count of attempting to murder his wife. Police release a statement to the media right away saying that Larry confessed to intentionally driving his car into the river and killing his children, even though he really didn't say that. They also say that he attempted to... Though he also, during his interrogation, I guess, says that he had attempted to blow up his house once 8 years earlier by leaving a candle burning near a gas leak in the basement while his wife and son were asleep. Which I don't fucking, that makes no sense to me. Like, why would you confess that unless it's like that is so specific?
Well, unless it's planted somehow or there's some...
Or he did it on accident. Once.
Or he's just putting, if he's in a weird trance-like state, I mean, who knows what got suggested or what got floated that then kind of popped up in his mind. I mean, this is a fascinating, that idea of like, coerced confession or false confession.
Yeah.
It's such a fascinating thing what the brain can and will do.
Yeah.
And what you start agreeing to when you're under duress and all that stuff.
It really does look like he's in a trance or hypnotized. It's really creepy.
It's so weird.
Also,
both of these ways of having people die, even if you're a psychopath or sociopath, are so awful. Like having people blow up where you're not guaranteed that everyone's going to die. People get just terribly injured and you have to take care of them the rest of your life. Like you're putting your car with yourself in it. Yeah. That's the part.
And you don't know how to swim.
You don't know how to swim. You're fucking in the car.
Yeah.
Your wife's in the car.
Yeah. She can swim out easily.
It doesn't make it. It's not easy. It's not the cleanest way to do something.
No. And like if he was intending to do it, did he know it was 30 feet deep and how long it would take for someone to come get the kid? Like they could have all survived for all he knew.
Yeah, they could have hit the thing and floated.
Exactly. Right. Or they're, you know,
All right.
So did he? So quotes from the confession, they take quotes from the confession to give to the media, but without the content. So when he's almost like asking, what if I did do it? You know, like they take those quotes and put them out there without any context. Or subtext and the
context.
The public is outraged and can't understand how an average Joe, you know, a store manager at a mechanic place with no criminal record could do something like this. And they are fucking pissed about it. Since the accident, Suzanne is stuck by Larry's side and through the trial she does as well. It leads the public to wonder if she is in on the murder plot, maybe for the fucking insurance money. And she can't go out in public without people yelling obscenities at her. And she's called night and day with threatening phone calls.
Fuck.
She's lost her 4 fucking children.
That's why they went out of town.
Yeah.
That's why they went out of town.
Yeah.
Now it makes sense.
Yeah.
You want to get away from all these fucking, like,
it's also, like, do you want to go back home right now to those bedrooms where your four children are sleeping and see all their toys and shit and know they're never coming home? Like, I wouldn't want to go home.
No way.
I want to go to a hotel or something and not have to.
But then I will devil's advocate and say they got into that death station wagon. I mean,
good point.
Just to do that.
Good point.
But still.
Yeah.
But then with the house part, it has to be two people agreeing. Like, it has to be. I don't know. Oh, anyway.
I don't either. So for months leading up to the trial, the story is regularly in the paper and the news, and new details are constantly released, such as suggestions that the family was in debt, that they argued all the time, and of course how creepy it is that the family kept the car that Larry's dad shot himself in and had bloodstains in still.
Yeah.
Eventually, the confession and interrogation video is thrown out by the trial judge, whose name is Robert Colombo Jr., which is like the best fucking coolest name I've ever heard.
Robert Colombo Jr.?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Colombo.
He makes good, like, pasta sauce.
Yeah, we're calling him Colombo now.
Okay.
Who ruled that the video, which is great, the video was an involuntary statement. So the video's thrown the fuck out.
So he's seeing the same thing you're seeing of like this, he's just talking.
This is not a confession. Yeah. But Colombo rejects the idea of moving the case out of town. So it's been this crazy huge news story. People are emotionally fucking attached to this story too, right? And five of the people who eventually got picked to be on the jury admitted that they had heard all about the confessions and had been following the case, which how can you not?
Yes.
It's like your town.
It's
crazy.
Your town.
The biggest story in your town. But they pinky swore or whatever that they wouldn't let it affect their decision.
Come on.
And I'm like, Colombo, you just wanted the fucking notoriety.
You didn't want it to be moved because you wanted to stay in the middle of it.
Yeah, it's hard because on one hand you're like, great, he's like making a fair ruling about the confession tape, but that's fucking insane. That's the whole point of why we move trials, is so that you can get a jury that's as unbiased as possible. They're going home that night and the fucking on the news is the trial story.
Well, and also these are all the same people who real time watch dead children be pulled from the river.
Exactly.
They're traumatized themselves. That affects you.
So like, you just need someone to be held responsible.
Yes. And you have a wound now that you need healed that kind of is, and that's so many people in that town or even that area.
Right. And all their friends who come over for dinner or that they see in the grocery store all want the same thing.
Yeah.
So, when the case went to trial in June, Wayne County Prosecutor Kevin Simoski, also not talking about his fucking career or him at all, except that he seems like a fucking douche. Again, he seems like he's from Animal House, like he's a Dan Aykroyd character, even with the fucking, the Dan Aykroyd accent thing. It's just grates on my nerves. I'm not saying anything about him.
Can I just say that Dan Aykroyd was not in Animal House?
I figured I got that wrong. But he reminds me of one of those. How about a Belushi?
Yes.
Okay. He's like a Belushi Aykroyd style,
Come on, guys.
Everyone's guilty. You know, he looked like, he just looked so 80s back then. It's just,
80s and Chicago accent? Or like that Midwestern accent?
Yeah.
A lot of flat A's.
Yeah. And he was real showy and flashy and,
Pinky ring?
Probably.
Okay.
I'm going to say yes, the pinky ring.
Okay.
He argued that Larry was a troubled man, drowning in debt, feeling burdened by life and by his wife and kids. Actually, in confession tapes, there's a funny, Larry's interviewed in it and you can hear, it's just his voice, you know, from prison. Oops, gave that one away. And he says, you know, when he was trying to coerce the confession, he was like, you know, your daughter's crying in the back seat and you just snapped. And Larry's like, I had four children who cried constantly.
Yeah.
If I were going to snap at a crying kid, I would have, you know, done it.
Three kids ago.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know,
that's true.
Which is, I think, a good point. Simowski argued that Larry deliberately planned the crash and fully intended to die along with the rest of his family that night. So his thing was that it was like a murder-suicide attempt.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Defense attorney Frank E-Man. claimed
he had a blonde page boy, right?
It was weird. Yeah. Eamon, I bet, claimed the car was defective, that Delisle was not guilty. He told reporters that the only reason Larry, quote, confessed to the crime was because police wore him down during the interrogation, with, again, no attorneys present, and basically brainwashed him and gave him a kind of nervous breakdown.
Mm-hmm.
And
which would be very easy to do for a man who's just lost his four fucking children.
Just lost his children, not as intelligent as the person who's doing the questioning.
Yeah.
You know? He says they erased Larry's real memory and planted a new idea into his head, one that held him responsible. Because also in the in question tapes, he's like, yes, I'm a piece of shit. I hate myself for the rest of my life. I killed my children.
Yeah.
But not saying he did it on purpose. Like, he was blaming himself too.
Right.
So he, you know, he was like wanting to take on the responsibility.
Of course he was.
Yeah.
If he didn't do it and it was as he said, it's still as bad because
he's fucked for life.
He's fucked for life.
Yeah. And his poor wife and everything, you know. Okay. The trial lasted, I just wrote 8. I'm going to think 8 days.
8 long minutes.
The trial lasted 8
mm-hmm.
days, with more than 24 witnesses called to testify, including nosy neighbor Beverly Lake, who said that the crash, quote, we saw something that was carefully planned. She described the crash as the most deliberate act she's ever seen, and that the car proceeded in a straight path between the barricades without swerving or deviating, and that there were no apparent signs of braking. Which is like, yes, that's what he said.
Yes.
She thinks... she's corroborating what he says, and she thinks it proves that he's guilty.
Well, she's just juicing it up and pretending that her vantage point
yeah.
from a building, an 11-story building, however many yards away, means that she knows the intention totally. Of what's happening. I mean, that's crazy that they let her even say it.
She's like the main witness, too. They were like so happy when they got her, which is like...
Did the defense rip her? I mean, like...
I don't think so. I don't
shit.
Know. I know. It's really like... it's really problematic.
I'd be like...
And she's interviewed during this show, too. And you want to be like, yell at her. But she thinks she did something good.
Right.
She thinks she did a good thing.
If I worked for the defense, I would have been like, rebut, Your Honor. Beverly, how many pairs of binoculars do you have? 11
yeah.
pairs of binoculars.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And an expert in accident reconstruction. So there's a whole problem with the way they tested the car, too. Sergeant Weldon Greiger testified that the car had to travel about 40 feet at about 40 to 47 miles per hour. So that's how fast it went.
Okay.
A man named Brian Ross, he was in a boat on the river that night.
Oh, shit.
So he saw the car go underwater.
Ugh.
And he testifies that the car went under in a matter of seconds, and that Larry surfaced quickly right above where the car had gone under, and that Larry didn't say anything when he got out there. He never went under the water again. And he was just sitting there treading water. And Suzanne popped up downriver. So she, you know, panicked or tried to get one of the kids, maybe, who knows, popped up downriver and was hysterical when she got up there
mm-hmm.
and said that she was spitting out water and screaming, my babies. And then she tried to go back underwater. So she did what I think most of us would have done.
Yes.
And he didn't. And that is problematic. But he also didn't know how to swim. And he
didn't know how to swim, but he could tread water.
Yeah. I don't know. That's weird.
Yeah, that is weird. But also, he could also have been in full shock.
Totally.
And like, he could have been, like his hearing was out.
Right.
He could have just like not known where he was.
Sure.
And been completely, who knows what happened when that car hits the water, he could have slammed his head on the steering wheel.
I mean, it hit it with enough force to break out the windshield.
Yeah.
The expert car witness for the prosecution said that nothing had been wrong with the car, despite the fact that the choke stuck once in 21 tests on the car. So they tested it 21 times, and then one time, something happened where it stuck, or it was revving up in neutral.
Yeah.
The accelerator was still going in neutral. After that one time in 21, they tested it one more time and then stopped the tests. So that happened like at try 20, and they were like, no, it's fine. Like, they wouldn't keep testing it because they didn't want, you know, the outcome of something's wrong with the car.
Right.
And
that doesn't seem fair.
No, it doesn't. And also, the arresting officer, he was on the stand, the jury stand, was on the stand, witness stand, because on the top of his notepad during a test ride with police, he wrote, quote, accelerator sticking. And then during the trial, he swore under oath that he had no idea why he wrote that. It was just happened to be there.
Come on.
I know. So Suzanne testified that the car's engine had raced in the past, including sometimes while they were in the car. One defense witness, mechanic James Cokewell, testified that the car's accelerator cable was bent. Its engine mounts were cracked, which pulls the accelerator cable and causes the accelerator to stick. That's what happens when that, when I guess engine mounts are cracked.
Okay.
I'm not a car person.
We and should become car
we people. Should. Let's make this into a car podcast. call it car talk. Perfect.
Become men.
Yeah. And one of its throttle plates appeared to stick. So I'm sure that means something to someone.
Mm-hmm.
The jury deliberated almost 9 hours over 2.5 days, which is like 3 hours a day. You know, it's not that big of a deal. deputies were brought into court, like into the courthouse and outside, to stand guard in case of a fucking riot when the verdict got read.
Oh my God.
Because that's how crazy the fucking town was about this case.
I bet.
You know? And the jury found Larry guilty on all counts. At sentencing, Colombo said that he had serious questions about whether the proceedings had been fair. So even he was like, I call bullshit on this.
And okay.
Probably if it had been a, what is it called? A bench trial, which means the judge is the
judge, no jury. Not jury.
Yeah. Then he probably would have been let off.
Wow.
When they did try to get one and it was denied.
Right. Because he fucking left it in at the center of the crime.
Right. Wait, what?
Like that he left it in town.
Right.
So, of course they're, yeah. I mean, that's the whole point of leaving in town, right? Then all the people in town come and give their opinion.
That's right.
Oy.
And he, so Larry's sentenced to 5 concurrent terms in life prison.
Shit.
About 5 years after his sentencing, Suzanne and Larry divorced. He says it's because he looked so much like their children. It was just too hard for her. She was heartbroken, clearly, and she's fallen off the radar. Let's not try to find her.
Never.
Please. Defense attorney Frank Eamon now wishes that the confession tape had gone into trial and they had been able to see it, because it would have shown how much Larry had been broken down and coerced.
Mm-hmm.
So if only they could have seen it.
Yeah.
You know? And Larry's case is taken to the Supreme Court, but they denied to hear it, and he's exhausted all his appeals. So the only change would have to come if the governor said so.
Really?
Of Michigan. Yeah. And that's the case of Larry Delisle and his poor family.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, that is why I don't watch shows like Confession Tapes.
Yeah.
I'm going to fucking think about Larry Delisle and the did he or didn't he for the rest of my life now.
And it won't matter because his fucking poor children are still dead.
They're dead either way.
Yeah.
And it won't matter because, I'm sure there's part of him. Let's just say best case scenario. The best case scenario is that he's innocent, but that he was put away.
Yeah.
Because he was coerced. But he still wanted to be put away.
Yeah.
Because this horrible thing happened. Like,
it's troubling. I love did they or didn't they cases, but it's when someone didn't get a fair trial or have false confessions or were like fucking, you know, railroaded somehow, that those are the ones I can't stand.
Yeah. Well, when it's not clear in a place where like you would want, and this is, you know, what is why this is such a topic of conversation these days, is because we've all kind of like blindly assumed this is done correctly. This is the place where things are done correctly.
Right.
It's the court system.
You're going to get what you deserve.
Yep.
Either it's good all or bad. Very,
look, you got a lawyer. This is how it, you know, it's all that shit where it's like, oh no. This is one of the most fucked up systems. There's fucked up shit happens all the time. And we only know now. We're, you know, slowly learning of like the way police do things and how things can't be allowed.
Yeah.
And you have to have your lawyer there.
Yeah.
That's the reason. It's the law.
It doesn't make you guilty if you ask for a lawyer immediately. It doesn't make you guilty if you don't cry on camera.
Right.
Or, you know, but who knows? Maybe he is guilty.
Also, just the idea that they showed dead children on the news is just like, that should never be allowed.
No.
It's so terrible.
No, never.
Wow.
Yeah.
Good one.
Thank you.
If you're like me, you're always looking for a story to dive into. Whether it's a family drama or a mystery to solve, the key to getting hooked is the details. I need rich visuals and intricate storylines, and June's Journey has that and more. June's Journey is a mobile mystery game that follows June Parker, a daring young woman, on a quest to uncover the truth about her sister's murder. This is your chance to test your detective skills because you'll play the game as June herself. Explore beautifully designed scenes from the 1920s, like lavish estates and gardens, and don't forget to keep an eye out for hidden clues. There are twists, turns, and catchy tunes, all leading you deeper into the thrilling storyline. And if you play well enough, you could make it to the Detective Club. There, you'll chat with other players and compete with or against them. June needs your help, but watch out, you never know which character might be a villain. Shocking family secrets will be revealed, but will you crack the case? Find out as you escape this world and dive into June's world of mystery, murder, and romance. It's all just one tap away. Discover your inner detective when you download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android. That's June's Journey. Download the game for free on iOS and Android. Goodbye.
Georgia, have you ever been blown away by the most simple dish at a restaurant, like perfectly scrambled eggs?
Oh my God, yes, Karen. And then all I want to do is make that dish at home and eat it every day.
Well, you probably could, as long as you have the chef's secret ingredient, Made In cookware.
Made In was created to bring restaurant quality performance kitchenware to home chefs around the world.
For years, they've built their business by supplying restaurants and top chefs with high-end cookware. Some of Tom Colicchio's most treasured dishes at his restaurant Kraft are made in Made In.
Whether you're cooking for professional critics or just the critics you live with, your meals will benefit from the quality of Made In products.
Like their carbon steel cookware, it combines the best of both cast iron and stainless steel clad, so it's rugged enough for grills or an open flame. It's the MVP of summer cookouts and cook-ins. What I really love about Made In cookware is that it actually makes something like having a Memorial Day barbecue much more convenient, because you can keep everything on the grill. If you need to throw, say, a pan of garlic up on the top while you're grilling your steaks on the bottom, it's strong enough, durable enough to do that.
If you want to take your cooking to the next level, remember what so many great dishes have in common. They're all Made In, Made In.
Save up to 25% this Memorial Day from May 18th through May 27th when you visit madeincookware.com.
That's M-A-D-E-I-N cookware.com. Goodbye.
Okay. Well, so my case this week is one that I actually started when we were on the European tour. Mm-hmm. And was going to do on that. Didn't we have a day off in Stockholm? Wasn't there?
Yeah.
A little extra time
yes,
there?
Yes.
So I started it. And then had enough time to second guess myself.
Love it.
And was like, this is too new.
Yeah.
And this might actually be a bummer. I think I was particularly worried about the shows in Norway and Stockholm.
That's right, you were.
Because I was like, they're not going to speak English.
They're going to hate us.
I made up all these things of what they were going to do. And then they were like the best audiences.
Yeah, they were great.
Who spoke better English than us.
Yeah.
And were hilarious.
Yes.
Okay. So anyway, but it turned, everything was as it was supposed to be, but I really, really want to tell the story. We talked about it when it happened real time last year.
Oh, I know what you're doing.
It's the murder of Swedish, journalist, freelance journalist, Kim Wall.
Oh my God.
And because it's so new, and because it's when, cases are this new, it's just a series of newspaper articles that mm-hmm. everybody's getting their information from. Mm-hmm. So, most of what I have here are quotes and pulls from articles from the BBC News. Because okay. BBC News was all over this and seemed like they
and
were covering
so
it.
They're so smart too.
They're so British. They're yeah. smart, but they're calm.
Yeah.
They know how to line up.
Yeah.
And, you know, tea.
Don't ask any questions about tea.
Yeah, exactly. So we'll just talk about Kim Wall for a second. Okay. So her name was Kim Isabel Frederica Wall, and she was born March 23rd, 1987, to her parents, Ingrid and Joachim Wall, in a close-knit community in the small town of Trelleborg in southern Sweden.
Ooh.
She graduated from high school. She was obviously super brilliant, because listen to this college career that I was like, God, that's a lot of homework. She studied international relations at the London School of Economics.
I bet they're smart.
It's hard to get in there.
I don't understand numbers.
You have to have so many, what do they call those?
Numbers.
so many numbers in your pocket. You have to do a
pounds.
Lot of what?
You have to have a lot of pounds to
Yeah, you have your parents have to have pounds and you have to have numbers in your head. She got a bachelor's degree there, and then she went to New York, and she got into Columbia in the journalism department, which apparently is very, very competitive and really hard to get into.
Wow.
She graduated top of her class with honors, and she had a dual master's degree in journalism and international relations from Columbia. So this is a very, very intelligent woman who's also obviously very ambitious, knows exactly what she's into. And then they have just a ton of great quotes from her friends, like her classmate, Anna Caudria Ratto was interviewed by the BBC and said that Kim was very bubbly and warm. She's the kind of person who had fantastic stories about all the stories that she was working on. And you could jump straight past the small talk, right? That's what we're all about. She was intellectual, so well-traveled, had all these varied interests, and she liked quirky and eccentric stories. So if you were at a party, you'd end up passing hours chatting with her.
So
it's just like, oh, I like her.
Yeah.
She's my friend. She also won, an award called the Hansel Meith Prize, awarded by a German newspaper that I cannot pronounce. I apologize. It looks like Süddeutsche Zeitung.
That's exactly right.
Perhaps.
I was testing you.
Now I can move to Germany. In March 2016, they gave her an award for the best digital reportage of a series called Exodus, which was her report on climate change and nuclear weapons testing in the Marshall Islands.
Wow, that's such smart stuff.
Smart stuff that was like, that's not, you know, the Circleville Pumpkin Festival every year, which is my report that I like to give. But this is clearly a woman. She reported on like the resurgence or the uprising of feminism in China.
Whoa.
She would do all these stories that were about like people who are underrepresented, about subculture is a word they use a lot.
She was a woman of substance.
She really was. And she hauled her ass around the world getting these stories. Damn. So she went everywhere. She seemed very brave. And her friend Victoria Grieve told Sweden's Expressen newspaper about life in she wrote about life in a huge shopping center in Kampala's Chinatown, about Cuba's underground internet providers who download and disseminate new episodes of Keeping Up with the Kardashians to people in Havana. We made a report together about the wealthy women in New York who voted for Donald Trump. So she was political and she did like personality profiles and kind of those pieces of like, meet your fellow humans in the world. But there are dangers to being a freelance journalist. Somebody named Shruti Gottipati. 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 Who wrote in the Guardian, as news organizations grapple with shrinking budgets, they increasingly rely on freelancers who cost less and are willing to take on the attendant risks reporting in places they wouldn't send their staff to.
Oh, what?
So
that's scary.
Yeah. Cause the competition's fierce and, female freelancers get out there and work really hard to prove that they're the same kind of reporters as anybody else. And they'll go get the stories and that they're willing to do all that, obviously. And they don't talk about the dangers themselves because they want to prove that they can do the job.
Yeah. It just sounds like they're complaining or something.
Right. Exactly.
They don't want to do that.
Yeah. They just want to keep getting the jobs and then hopefully have that get them, some kind of editorial job or whatever. So,
sure.
So, we'll go to this inventor, Peter Madsen. He's a Danish inventor who became famous around 2008 because he had built what he claimed to be the first largest privately built submarine, in the world. And it was 56 feet long. It was called, the UC3 Nautilus. and, or sorry, he did a series of submarines, the UC-1 Treya, the UC-2 Kraka, and the UC-3 Nautilus.
Is this like a thing that people do? Like make fucking submarines?
No, it's not at all. Okay. This guy is like, it's, he sounds to me in the way they describe him to be a, like a low rent Elon Musk.
Okay.
So basically,
because when they say he made the biggest one, I'm like, well, are there a bunch of smaller ones?
I know. Isn't, was submarine wise, wouldn't you want to go a little smaller if you're making it yourself?
Sure.
Like if you forget one, you know, oh, yeah, like a one screw somewhere, and then it's this big old thing because you had to have like a dining room.
Yeah. You run out of Gorilla Glue.
Yeah. I don't feel like length is, you should be super concerned with it when it's a submarine, but
yeah, you know how men are.
Who am I saying? It is all about size. Okay. So that's how he kind of bursts onto the scene. He becomes, famous, you know, in Denmark for basically being this kind of eccentric inventor. Mm-hmm. And, he does all this stuff with either, being fronted, shit, what's that called?
Oh, being like when they pay the money.
Venture capitalist. Okay. So it's venture capitalism. So he's like, he's, you know, like a mover and shaker where he's out there and he's like, I'm this inventor and I can make this and the new wave or personal submarines or whatever, however he did mm-hmm. it. And he gets people to kind of stake.
They're like, great, here's this money.
Yeah, here's 10 grand. I'm a venture capitalist and here's my blazer.
We are too. Give us fucking 10 grand. Rich people.
Yeah, we have all kinds of submarine ideas. but then he has that kind of personality where he's getting out there and he keeps getting himself in the paper. He's like, he becomes renowned yeah. as this eccentric inventor. And after the success of when he first came out with like, I made a submarine and I'm a self-taught engineer.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Then he partners with architect and former NASA contractor Christian von Bengsten, and they form a collective called Copenhagen Subordinals.
Sounds like villains from fucking Austin Powers movies.
Yes, it's very much shave your head and put your fingers like up to your lips mm-hmm. in a prayer position. Mm-hmm. They're actually a group of amateur rocket makers and they're working the aim of launching a manned rocket into space.
Oh yeah, me too.
So they're self-made NASA astronaut like rocketeers.
Calm down, dicks.
It's pretty bold when you're like, I didn't go to college for this, but how about you give me $25,000 and I'm gonna have a rocket go up?
I would rather have a not self-taught engineer make my rocket.
Same.
I would rather have someone who went to years and years of very hard school.
Yeah, like I would like an engineer that's gone crazy, like because he's so specific and he checks things 19 times.
Right, because he learned it from people who are smarter than him.
I want the guy that's got a bunch of books mm-hmm. that he has actually read.
Mm-hmm. I want a guy who's in fucking has student loan debt because he went to so much fucking schooling.
That's right. I want a guy that just asks me about me. Oh, wait, what are we doing?
Elvis is right here.
Okay, so that collective, Copenhagen Suborbitals, it falls apart in 2014. No and shit. The word, it comes out that it's basically because Peter Madsen is nutso.
Okay.
They say he was kind of a loner, really fighty. He's the kind of person that would throw a tool at you. Some men said they didn't find him to be intimidating in any way. And then some people said, and usually it was women, said that he was. So Yeah, he was one of those kind of people, like a little monster. He, after the Suborbitals group fell apart, he went on to create Rocket Madsen's Space Laboratory, which sounds like a show on the Cartoon Network.
It totally does.
And he set that up to directly compete with his ex-partners.
Oh, God.
Because he's a dick. Wrote on the organization's website, my passion is finding ways to travel to worlds beyond the well-known.
Well, submarines are pretty well known, Dick.
Yeah, I mean, that's just a bay. You've been there. Okay, so in 2015, there's another dispute, and this, for his new group, the Volunteers, because he's doing everything by, like, crowdfunding and getting people to volunteer to come help him mm-hmm. build these things. And these Volunteers were, like, they were the ones maintaining the Nautilus, and they were like, bye, we're out of here, and everybody walked. And he said in a statement on his website, quote, you may think that a curse is lying on the Nautilus. That curse is me. He wrote that.
Jesus.
And then he added, there will not be peace on Nautilus for as long as I exist.
He's so scary.
He seems crazy. Kim Wall had reached out to Peter Madsen in 2016 to get an interview with him. Because obviously, at that time, is like, who is this crazy submarine and rocket maker?
This will make a good story.
Yeah. Like, what's your deal? He never got back to her. A year later, she and her boyfriend, who was a designer, is named Ole, or O-L-E, Ole, they've decided to move to Beijing. So it's the night, August 10th, it's the night of their farewell party. Mm-hmm. And she gets a phone call, and it's Peter Madsen. And he's saying, I want to show you my newest personal submarine, the Nautilus. And he's like, "You can. I'll grant you an interview, and I'll show you how my submarine works." So she leaves. She goes and meets him.
Leaves her party?
Yeah. I don't know if the party had started. I don't know what time she got the call.
Okay.
This is the storiest story part of this story, because none of the newspapers really specify that, except for that, you know, at some point somebody said, they made it sound like it was the same night.
Okay.
So she was basically like, I'll be right back.
Yeah.
This will take me 3 hours.
Totally.
And I have to do it.
Yeah.
Cause it's like, she's waited a year.
Totally.
So she meets him at the harbor, mm-hmm. and there's a picture, and this is kind of famous on the internet. A person going by on a boat who saw the submarine sitting above the water in the harbor, and Peter and Kim were both on it, took a picture of them from the side of the boat. And that's essentially the last time anyone sees her alive, is that moment. So 8 hours later, she's not returned. She's not contacted anyone. So her boyfriend calls the police, and at 2:30 in the morning, reporting her missing, saying she went on the submarine with Peter Madsen. They left from here. Da da da. The same morning, later that morning, authorities are called out to rescue a man whose personal submarine was sinking.
Uh-oh.
And of course, it's Peter Madsen. And so the police question the 46-year-old inventor. He liked to describe himself. I should have put this up higher, as an inventrepreneur.
Me too. Oh my God. I like to describe him as an asshole.
I mean, if you call yourself anything, don't let it be, what is that? There's a word for words that are word combos like that. I'm an inventrepreneur.
I'm going to make up a new word.
Okay, Willy Wonka, take it easy. He also said that his work was to, quote, to challenge the ordinary. So he's
the ordinary's like, we're good.
Yeah, it's fine. You know what? How about just be a normal person?
Yeah.
He just sounds like a bullshit artist to me. Like one of those people that's good at raising money because he can say like buzz
cocky
phrases that people like.
Like a fucking head of a startup.
Exactly. And
no offense to heads of startups.
Steven just looked up a picture. Will you just tell Georgia what you describe him as?
Oh, I just said he looks like an ugly Daniel Craig.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
I could see that easily morphing into ugly.
Yes. He had, because he was in the press so much for all his inventions and being this eccentric inventrepreneur, he had actually had a biography written about him by a journalist named Thomas Gersing. And
I know you paid for it, right?
Well, I don't know. So that guy said that he was angry with God and everyone, and that he had a hard time getting along with other people, and his lofty ambitions caused him to want to do everything his way. So basically, dick.
Yeah.
And also, clearly, that's what other people that worked with him said, people who were having to walk off the job or like breaking up entire, you form this huge collective, and then everyone's like a year later, like not working with you anymore.
Not like us.
That's right.
Steven's been here the whole time.
He's been here most of the time. Half the time.
Yeah.
Okay. So when they're questioning him, he says he doesn't know where she is. The last time he saw her, she was alive. That before his submarine sank, he'd actually dropped her off very close to where they had originally met. Mm-hmm. and that she was fine last time that he saw her. Hmm. So everyone, he said she went to a restaurant at 10:30 and that was the last time that he saw her. He drove away in his little submarine and then terrible things happened to him. So they end up pulling up the sunken submarine. And they go over it. The forensics people find blood smears and they match it to Kim Wall's DNA.
Just like that.
Yep. And so they're like, here's the thing, Peter, why is her blood on the inside of if she walked off fine, then what happened? So then, he changes his story, singular, and, he says that actually what happened was that she was coming out of the hatch and he was holding it open for her and it slipped and it cracked on her head and it killed her, because it fractured her skull. And so he panicked and buried her at sea. And they're like, yeah, this doesn't track either. Then on, August 21st, a passing cyclist spots a washed up torso on an island, southwest of Amager. That poor person. And the DNA test identifies that it belongs to Kim Wall.
Okay.
A post-mortem examination finds 15 stab wounds.
My God.
Mostly on the lower part of this torso.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So then 10 days later, Copenhagen police investigator Jensen announces the police have found a bag that was submerged in the bay with Kim Wall's clothing. So it's a shirt, skirt, socks, and shoes, along with a knife weighed down by pieces of lead. And then, around noon that day, they find her legs and her head also in a bag, also weighted down. So then he changes his story.
Ugh.
And he says, because they say, so there's the skull, there's no skull fracture. So your whole thing, if she died because you dropped the hatch on her head, is a lie. And he goes, no, you're right. Here's what happened. We were up above the water, but she was down in the submarine and I was up on deck and there was a carbon monoxide leak and she died of poison of that. And I panicked.
Which is so stupid because that's a better story than you hitting her head. Like, that makes you seem like, so why would you start with hitting her head?
Because he didn't think through the fact that saying hitting her head, and then when he doesn't think they're going to find the body parts.
Yeah.
And he's not questioning any of that. He's just like, they're going to believe whatever I say. She's gone.
Yeah.
Which they're never gone.
Which even if they don't believe it, there's no way to prove it unless they find the body.
Right. And why would you think they wouldn't when this is then it's their job and they're going
idiotic.
To want it. So then the test comes back and of course there's no sign of carbon monoxide in her lungs and they're like, it's not happening. So he denies that he intentionally killed her, but he does admit to dismembering her and throwing her into the ocean. He calls it burying her at sea.
Jesus. Psychopath.
Insane. So on January 16th, 2018, Peter Madsen is charged with murder, indecent handling of a corpse, and, quote, sexual relations other than intercourse of a particularly dangerous nature. Because when they got test back, and there were stab wounds inside the genital area as well as outside. And so his trial begins on March 8th, 2017.
I feel so bad for the boyfriend.
Oh, it's horrible.
That he is probably blaming himself for not going with her.
That's not what she was like, though. That's what she did, stuff like that all the time. That was standard fare.
And you're like, I'm in business mode. Of course I'm going to go by myself to this place.
And he's an eccentric engineer. He's just a regular person that's been in the news. He's well known around Denmark.
And I totally would not expect that.
Yeah. He's not some it's not some weirdo that she picked from under a rock. Yeah. This is a guy that's been in the news for almost 10 years.
Shit, seriously.
So she probably, she felt safe, maybe he's weird, but that's part of the story is that he's weird.
Totally.
So when the trial begins, prosecution claims that Peter Madsen tortured Kim Wall before killing her by cutting her throat or strangling her. And they said that they believed that he had psychopathic tendencies. One reason is because they found snuff films on his computer. So he was watching really violent,
snuff films,
horrible porn. Yeah. And also there, people came and testified at his trial that said they had seen him watch videos of decapitation and choking to the point of asphyxiation. So they knew that he was like a violent creep. Like the people around him,
yeah,
like, showed up and were like, yep, I've got a story. Also, what kind of lunatic do you have to be to watch things like that where people can see you watching them?
Like, you think it's so fucking normal that you are fine with people knowing about it.
It's kind of like you see that every once in a while, people just looking at porn on a plane, where it's like, oh, you're
so, you think this is normal.
You're desensitized and you're so addicted that you're just like, fine, it's what I need. And also it's like, what are you going to do? Watch porn on a plane and then
watching porn to not masturbate, just watch it is so creepy.
I mean, there's so many angles to,
like, watch
to talk
porn,
about
I'm
creepiness.
Fine with it, but.
Okay, so anyway, when they question him about the dismemberment aspect of the murder, he stated on the stand, I don't see how that mattered at the time as she was dead. He said that in court.
I can do whatever I want to her dead body because she's dead.
Like, why are people upset? The body,
oh,
the body
my
was
God.
Dead is essentially the message he was sending. So, of course, on April 25th, Peter Madsen was
of this year.
Yeah.
It just happened.
It just happened.
Holy shit.
I mean, like, the murder happened at the end of last year, and then the case, that's why I didn't want to do it.
Yeah.
Is because the case was, like,
no, I think
fresh.
It's smart. Yeah. And people really wanted you to do this story, so I think it's better that you stayed for the podcast, too.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Because it would have been dead fucking silent.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the worst. It's sad. It's sad because it's this amazing young woman who was genius, right?
Yeah.
She's, like, super brilliant, had this great career, like,
kind
of
kind person who had friends and
was just like a lover of life.
Yeah.
And then this guy who just clearly, like, thought he could just kind of do whatever he wanted and make shit up, like, clearly thinks he's smarter than everybody else.
Yeah.
But the cool thing is, so when he's convicted on April 25th on all three charges, he's sentenced to life in prison, which we know in Scandinavia is very extreme.
Yeah.
But they also placed him in this thing called forvaring, which is a type of preventative custody with no time limit for prisoners believed to pose a significant danger to others. So it's more than it's more than the average. In fact, that's the harshest penalty in Danish law.
They're saying, like, even if you only get 20 years, we're keeping you in this place to make sure that even if 20 years comes up and you're not better, you have to stay in there longer.
Yeah.
I think that makes total sense.
Well, it's the thing of their life sentence is 20 years and they're saying no time limit.
Right.
Yeah. So it is the harshest thing you can get. And usually the only time anyone gets it is if there's multiple deaths, but they gave it to him in this case. So it's said he's going to appeal this sentence in Copenhagen's high court in September.
Oh, fuck him. Let's all go to Sweden. Listen, I don't want to go, right? But let's all go to Sweden.
Why not?
Yeah. No, I'm kidding. I'm making it seem like I.
Oh, I see. You're using it as an excuse. So after Kim Wall's death, her family and friends started something called the Kim Wall Memorial Fund. This is amazing. To fund and support freelance female reporters. Especially ones that are doing stories about subculture, like trying to give voice to the voiceless. In October 2017, she was posthumously nominated for Prix Europa's Outstanding Achievement Award for Journalist of the Year. And on November 26th, Swedish public television aired a documentary about her life entitled The Woman Who Wanted to Tell. I hope we can see that over here at some point. This was one of the most gruesome and closely watched cases in Scandinavian history.
Holy shit.
And that is the murder of Kim Wall.
Oh, Kim.
Yeah.
So sorry.
Kind of intense. Very short, though. That one, I mean, it's like there's not as much of the detail that usually happens.
But it was so crazy to see that unfolding of, like, then they found this and then they found that in the news. And
I remember seeing that picture of her face in your old apartment when we first talked.
Oh.
Because we talked about it when the story broke.
That's right. Everyone was sending it to us.
Yeah. And it was kind of like, wait, wait, wait. It was so, you know, it's like a good story.
Unexpected. What so happened? Sinister.
Yeah. Disgusting.
We and don't like, believe or trust this guy.
Yeah.
Well, that's really sucky.
Yeah. Also, I can't remember if I said this or not, but the cops did find that he sunk his own submarine.
Oh, sure.
So yeah. He was trying to hide all that. They found a saw on the submarine. They found a screwdriver on the submarine. He had no explanation as to why he needed either of those on the submarine. I mean, like,
just think someone bought that submarine and is now like, well, I don't care what happened. I'm gonna drive it. Like how people buy houses where people have died in them.
Or station wagons.
Yeah.
Like, just keep it. Just keep it.
We don't have the money to buy a new submarine.
Here's, we get the family into the submarine.
Yeah.
This is the thing I wanted to say during yours, but I didn't want to be so insanely disrespectful.
Please
but
don't.
There was also the element of like, what if it's now the haunted station wagon?
Well, that's what they say in the confession tapes is fucking Beverly Lake, who's just the Miss Know-It-All, says, there was this movie out of the time called where the car killed everyone called Christine, you know, and it was like, well, that doesn't really fit this. Also, go to bed.
Also, don't talk about that shit. Yeah. I get to talk about it on my dumb murder podcast, but like, if you're...
She says, like, and I was joking, and I know this isn't funny, and it's just like, well, then why are you saying it?
We're the last people that are allowed to say that.
Fair enough. Do you want to go first?
Sure. I started watching it, so everyone knows, and I don't think we talked about it, but very tragically, Anthony Bourdain committed suicide a couple weeks ago, right around the same time that Kate Spade committed suicide.
So insane.
Which, you know, the thing that I kept reading on social media that I think is really interesting is that everyone assumes that if you are rich or if you are successful, mm-hmm. that means you're happy. Mm-hmm. And that is absolutely not the case. As someone who's lived in Los Angeles for a long time and met lots of famous / you know, successful people, I can assure you it has no bearing. And sometimes it's the opposite.
Yeah.
It's what makes people really unhappy.
Or they're like, I have this and I'm still not happy. And it makes you even more unhappy because you realize that that isn't going to solve your problems.
And they interpret it as there's something inherently wrong with them.
Yeah.
And, it's super tragic. So I always heard of Anthony Bourdain. I always assumed that was an area I wasn't interested in because it was cooking. Like, I kind of took myself out of like
cooking, not interested.
I mean, but I love Chef's Table, but I always assumed it's because the way they made it was so filmic and like that.
He doesn't even really do cooking.
No, I just assumed I knew what it was. Yeah. I do that all the time. Yeah. Like, oh, here's the show. So I started watching, Parts Unknown.
Yeah.
And Parts Unknown is on Netflix.
Yeah.
And I highly recommend it. And this also kind of does actually tie in a little bit with Kim Wall. I think it's so important if just try to travel, try to like go outside of your normal town or state or area where you grew up. Try to be around people that are different than you. Try to eat food that is weird to you.
Yeah.
Try to be less comfortable, live less comfortably and experience the world more. I think it's so important. And it seemed to me that's kind of what Anthony Bourdain was all about.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
It's so cool because he would just be in these places. Like the first episode is Myanmar, Myanmar, which used to be Burma. And I had no idea about any of it. Yeah. Every single word he said in that episode was an education to me.
Yeah.
And the fact that they went and shot it was like, yay, now I don't have to go there and I don't have to eat fish. But secondhand, it's such an incredible experience to kind of open your eyes to like how other people live. And I don't know, I recommend it so highly. It feels like legitimately enriching. And then it also makes his death really, really sad because he doesn't understand. And this is the truth of it. We don't understand what we're bringing to the table. We don't understand what people take away from us.
Or we feel overburdened by the expectations people have of us too.
Yeah, but that's made up too.
Yeah.
Like that you make up expectations. You don't know what people really fucking think, but you don't know what they think good and you don't know what they think bad. But I think there's a certain personality type that always assumes it's bad when actually it's amazing.
Yeah.
And like just sitting there watching it going, I love this guy and I love his life philosophy.
He's amazing. He definitely brought cultures to people who had never had any experience from that culture through the best possible way, which is their food.
Yeah, that's great. Well, and he talks to all these real people.
Yeah.
It's not, he's just so cool. He's just a really cool person, obviously, to hang out with and eat with. He wasn't, because I think the foodie people can be a bit distancing because it's like a big race to name the cheese or whatever. And you're just like, I don't fucking know. And it didn't seem like that was his deal. He was more appreciative and kind of like, look at this.
Well, what I loved about what he always did in every episode, like, you know, lots of episodes, one of the things he would do, he'd go to the nicest restaurant in this city. He would go to the farmer's market. He would go to this cafe or whatever. But he would also always go to someone's home and have like their grandmother make him a meal that they always ate, like, you know, this is what the peasants ate, or this is the, you know, that everyone here grew up eating this food. And so that was always really eye-opening, going to someone's home, meet the family, and not just from a like restaurant point of view or
cafe. He went to a place in Quebec, in Montreal, where they make this sandwich that's so crazy looking because it's like a pile. It looks like it was like spam with a pile of bologna and then they fry it.
Oh my God.
There, and there's mustard and then maybe a cheese on there or something. And you're looking at it. It's one of those places where you can't order, you can't go like no mustard for me or whatever.
Yeah,
you have to have it as they make it. And he bites into it and he's just like, that's delicious.
Yeah.
And then you're just kind of like, it's that thing. It's the appreciation of, I sent you guys on Twitter, or I added you guys on Twitter when he goes to Waffle House with the, with the cook, with a chef who's explaining to him why Waffle House is so great.
Totally.
And that's a great video if you can find it.
Yeah.
It's super good.
I love that.
Yeah.
Well, actually, it's funny because my loves is going to lunch by myself. Mm-hmm. I did it yesterday after one of our meetings. There was a place that I had been, I'll get into these fucking hour long, like scroll sessions of a hashtag of a restaurant on Instagram and just look at all their food. I'll go look at their menu. I pick out what I would order. And I did that and realized the night before, I realized on our way home the other day that I was right by there. And so I went in and had lunch alone and read about my murder for this week and just kind of enjoyed myself. And that's just like this lovely little pleasure I have. I don't like going to see movies alone. I don't like any of that shit. I just want to go sit and eat a really cool, you know, order whatever I want and have this nice lunch alone. It's kind of one of my favorite things.
Awesome.
I also wrote a movie with my dad, because my dad spent the night last night and he and I accidentally got drunk and we watched this. So my uncle Michael Hardstark was an actor way back in the like 70s, and he is in a fucking campy as shit horror movie. It was Brooke Shields' first movie called Alice Sweet Alice.
Yes. Wait, is Betty Davis in it?
Is she?
Oh, you would know. If you watched it, you would know.
Okay. Well, maybe. Well, it's really campy. I feel like it should be one of those campy horror movies that everyone watches, but it's not for some reason. But you can get it, I don't know, online somewhere, like Amazon or one of those places.
He's in that movie.
Well, so what happened was, he was going to be like the assistant detective. There was like the main guy was like this famous actor who was going to be the detective. And that guy got a fucking role on Broadway. So he latered off the fucking show. And my uncle, Michael Hardstark, who looks like a cross between, what's the guy from Zodiac who's so cute?
Jake Gyllenhaal?
No, the other one.
Oh, Ruffalo.
Ruffalo.
Yes.
He looks like a more pockmarked, like Columbo style Ruffalo.
Yes.
And
please.
He's in it and it's great. So everyone go watch Alice Sweet Alice. Also get drunk with your dad on Rosé. It's so much fun. My dad is so hilarious and sweet.
I love it.
Yeah.
That's really good. That's a nice Father's Day.
Yeah.
Tee off.
Marty! Did you see his tweet about Starbucks?
No, what did he say?
He wrote a tweet saying, I'm going to start using the name Marty at Starbucks instead of Martin to see if there's any murderinos working at Starbucks.
Oh, no.
He's like on board with this.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah.
That's so hilarious.
Yeah. So happy Father's Day, Marty.
Oh, my dad's not on board with anything I do.
They're going to meet one day. It's going to be so fun.
Oh, well, they'll have some beers.
Yeah. Thanks for listening, you guys. You're fucking sweet angel babies.
Yeah, thanks for everything. And, you know, stay sexy.
And don't get murdered.
Goodbye.
Elvis, you want a cookie?
Oh.
Want two cookies? Yeah. What else?